Hello, everyone, and welcome to Please Expand. Today we have a very special episode. This is Julia's first her debut as the host of an interview of an episode.
Yes, I
So,
was very excited to try and do it myself.
after many successful outings as pre and post interview co-host, and then after an extremely well-received co-hosting outing with Michael Hunter on The Decline of Magic, Julia has struck out by herself. And who are you interviewing today, Julia?
So today we're gonna talk. I'm going to talk with Stefan Haik about his book, The Currency of Politics, The Political Theory of Money from Aristotle to Keynes, which was published in May 2022.
And do you want to tell us a bit about Stefan Eich? What's his background?
After the PhD at Yale, he's currently an assistant professor of government at Georgetown University. His research is in political theory, intellectual history, and history of political thought. And his area of expertise, as you will notice, lies in the political theories of money and the politics of financial capitalism.
Well, that's a topic that we haven't done yet on the podcast, so it was great that you found this book.
I think I was very eager to bring economics to the podcast, and I think after this discussion and having spent these couple months on his book, I really think I would like to do a couple books more on economical thought. He's currently working on a book on Keynes, which is the subject of the last chapter of the book we're going to discuss today, and I look forward for that to being published.
And could you maybe just give us a little roadmap of how the interview will go?
Absolutely. So the book is both tracing a historical and a conceptual genealogy of how the concept of money has evolved in time, and in particular, in what respects we can do and should think of money as a political institution, which is extremely interesting because the first time you read the book, you really have the sense, as I told him as well, you really have the sense that we're not used to think about money itself as political at all. And every time I was talking with you or with friends about the book, everyone was asking questions that would make clear that they would understand the subject as being part of economics or of, I don't know, financial theories. It's hard to see it as part of political theory, which is his point precisely, that the political nature of money has been hidden more or less consciously, that now it's not possible to see money as not being political, and that we need to acknowledge it. And that the question is not whether money is political, but what kind of politics we do want it to be associated with.
Fantastic. And you're going to talk about Aristotle,
Ah, yes,
Locke.
sorry. You asked for a roadmap. Yes, so the book consists of six chapters plus the epilogue. And Stefan talks about several authors. So we're going to go through Aristotle, Locke, Fichte, Marx, and Keynes as they play as the main turning points in this history that he wants to, in this story, actually, that he wants to tell of how the concept of money evolved. And here and there, I'm going to try. Basically, my whole aim was to spell out a bit further what he meant by political, what he meant by depoliticization, what is his positive view, beyond, of course, trying to understand better how each of these authors builds this taxonomy and what role each of them plays within the big picture.
Well, that all sounds very interesting.
Let's
And
see
I
if I
think
managed.
so. Why don't we get on to the interview then?
Yes, absolutely. And I was about to say, also, let me say that Stefan has been a pleasure to discuss with, that he's a great interlocutor, both professionally and personally, but then I didn't want to come across as a fangirl. But I really wanted to put black on white that it's been also very, very pleasant to just chat with him from a personal perspective. Hope you enjoy it. We'll talk later.
Yeah, see you in a bit.
Hello to Stefan Eich. Do I pronounce that correctly?
Yes, nice to
Perfect.
be here.
And nice to meet you. It's such a pleasure to have you on Please Expand. So thank you so much for accepting our invitation. Today, we're going to talk about money, the currency of politics, which I must say is one of the, if not the nonfiction book that I've read recently that caught my all attention and inspiration of all of them, because it's quite difficult, I find, when writing nonfiction books to maintain a level of depth and subtlety. And I just found your book not only beautifully written, but just extremely conceptually precise. And you make certain moves that are just elegant. So it was a pleasure to read it.
Thank you. Thank you.
My understanding is that the main aim of the book is to bring back to the forefront the political nature of money, which ended up to be conceived as politically neutral as a subject matter. I think that part of your argument is that political theorists and maybe philosophers in general have left it as a subject matter to economists, something that just exists. And you take political theorists to be guilty of this. What you do is you retrace the historical genealogy of this neglect by looking at several authors. You make it the case for the importance to think once again about its political nature, what that means, what kind of politics is associated with it, who has the role, the power, the right, and the duty to decide what that politics should be. Would you agree that this is the main takeaway from your book, or would you place its essence somewhere else?
That was a very good summary. I would only challenge maybe the very first thing that you said, which is that the point of the book is to bring money back into politics. In some way, I think that's already happened. For me, the premise of the book was, in some way, the world we find ourselves in has already revealed this to us. And I think since the financial crisis, again, with the kind of COVID monetary shocks, we've been all in a world in which it's beyond question that there is some kind of connection between money and politics. So we already were ejected out of the old world in which money was simply neutral. That had already collapsed. The problem was that the conceptions of politics that we were trying to use to make sense of our current moment were insufficient, I thought. They were still entrapped in the past. They were insufficiently attuned to the complexities and the historical depth. But for me, it was a moment of being thrown into this rather than kind of trying to pull something from people's eyes. I think we were already all in that moment of sudden aha and shock in many different ways. And so for me, it wasn't so much about going into history to show, money has always been political, but instead to understand, first of all, the many, many different ways in which people have drawn that connection between money and politics, because it can develop in radically different ways. Right? You can believe, precisely because money is so important politically, that it needs to be removed from political discretion, right? Or the opposite. So the history doesn't give us a straightforward idea of what that relationship looks like. And secondly, I was interested in understanding why this is so difficult. Some way why we seem to be observing a pattern whereby in moments of monetary crises, there is this aha effect. People are very interested in the relationship between money and politics. And they have various ideas about how that could be recreated and refounded. And then very quickly, these ideas subside and disappear, almost violently shut out. And instead, you end up with what I call in the book, a kind of politics of depoliticization.
That's super helpful. I would say that my aim with this interview is exactly to understand better what you mean by political nature and by depoliticization. Probably part of the difficulty is exactly what you said, that there are so many ways of understanding in what sense money could be political. Probably there's no escape to being confused about, or maybe the question can't be settled. Maybe there is no one way in which all the ways in which money is political can be encompassed. My plan is to retrace your genealogy and invite you to spell out exactly what is the role of each of the authors you consider within this journey you lead the reader through, and exactly, to understand a bit better what is political nature. Before doing so, however, I wanted to prepare the field a little bit and build up a little conceptual toolbox, because the book does get technical here and there, and I just wanted the listener to be on board from the get-going. So one key distinction, just on 2 points, one key distinction that you draw right at the beginning is between theories that see money or the money system as a commodity of convenience and those that see it as a technology of credit.
Yeah, I would actually pit two slightly different narratives against one another, because the credit field, I think, is so much vaster than people have appreciated. And I think most of the interesting debates actually happen within that area. So for me, the starting point was, as I presume it would be for many, the clash between what is sometimes described as the orthodox position and then, you know, against it, a kind of heterodox position. And so the orthodox position, as you described, is usually the one that is introduced in kind of introductory economics textbooks, where money is simply a kind of commercial technology of convenience, of efficiency. You know, and you get a kind of gradual developmentalist account of moving from barter towards some kind of metal money, towards some kind of credit, paper money, credit money eventually, and so on. That's the account that has very little room for the state, very little room for politics. It's simply about private commercial transactions rendered more efficiently. And then almost the exact inverse of this, an account that has, you know, really entered the field quite forcefully over the last 10 years, precisely in this period, post-financial crises and debates in new political economy, is you know, the heterodox story that essentially insists on money as you know, a kind of obligation that states force on its subjects. And there you have the exact opposite picture. So it's not about private transactions. It's not about markets. In fact, on that picture, money precedes markets. It's also primarily a story that revolves around the state and taxation. Okay. So these are the two dominant accounts. And I think they both capture something. But what I was struck by, both as a political theorist and as a historian, is how incredibly kind of conjectural they both are. They are both kind of almost fairy tale stories of either this kind of, you know, gradualist, developmentalist story that one could imagine could have happened, but actually it turns out doesn't quite map onto the actual evidence that archaeologists and anthropologists have been able to muster. Or in the orthodox case, a kind of like peculiar way in which the state is just simply there, fully formed, not itself historicized, as if some kind of ancient ruler 3,000 years ago had the full fiscal powers of the kind of 20th century warfare and welfare state. So history seemed to be missing in both cases. And I think as a result, a kind of more complicated conception of politics as something that is there to shape markets, but also that is structuring the kind of decisions that states are making, the ways in which states are themselves the outcome of a historical political process and contested fundamentally, you know, through processes of democratization. So it was by, in some way, sidestepping these two much more conventional accounts and fusing the two and looking in the space between them that I think we get a more interesting historical account, but also one that frees up a space for debate concerning the political theory of money, where the politics is neither missing, as in the first case, or obvious, fully formed, and it's just kind of our failure if we just don't do what it tells us to do. But instead, politics as this contested area. And this goes actually to your first definition of definitions of politics. I don't know whether we want to get into this now, but for me, it was important to have operate with different conceptions of the political and politics. And on one level, I try to use a very thin conception that just simply takes into account struggles over how to live together. And that can be extremely broad, and it can encompass moves that we might want to describe as, you know, rhetorically positioned as anti-political or naturalizing. But these are still moves in deciding how one lives together. You know? So that's a very thin way. And that's the way in which I describe money as inescapably political, as always already political. And then we can add other layers to that in the course of the discussion.
Yeah, I'm going to press you more on this as time progresses, but this is extremely helpful. And also something that I very much liked about the book is that you draw this distinction at the beginning, but then exactly you say that they're overly simplistic. So none of the authors that then you go on analyzing fit clearly within one or the other party, exactly because there are no two parties that can be that sharply distinguished. And another of these distinctions is the one between nominalists and naturalists. Could you just say a bit more about what that distinction is about?
Yeah, I mean, in one reading, you could almost map them onto the two camps that we've seen beforehand. And that might not be a bad way to start, whereby if you conceive of money as purely the outcome of private commercial transactions, there is a way in which value emerges not as something that is politically constructed, but as something that is somehow residing in the nature or the natural scarcity of certain commodities that then get chosen to be objects of moneyness, if you so want. And so from that perspective, the way in which you evacuate politics is by rooting value in nature and by rooting money in nature. And then it's just a question of what kind of, you know, objects and qualities of moneyness are you looking for, and where do you find them in nature? And that often tends to produce this affinity, which we know from history, between, you know, adherents of the gold standards, who kind of see some link between the kind of natural scarcity of precious metals, or maybe even other attributes of precious metals, like the, that seems to be something about the shininess of gold that that has attracted humans for a very long time. But some link between this and the way in which it just happens to function as a convenient kind of mediator for the purpose of transaction, as well as a convenient store of value. But in some way, these are natural attributes that just happen to exist out there. On the extreme other side is a nominalist strand of this kind of heterodox camp, which insists that units of value don't arise from nature, but they are imposed. They are kind of they are nominalist entities that some ruler essentially invents and then rolls out and forces upon the population. Right. So nominalism here is tied to a specific form of political power, sovereign political power, that is able to realize its own nominalism. Now, as you already mentioned, if you actually look at thinkers in the long history of political and economic thought, it turns out they don't really fit neatly into these camps. And actually, there are many more connections between the two than you might think. So I don't want to be misunderstood as being seen to endorse these two positions, but they are helpful as a kind of initial way to categorize. And I myself, when I first started to get into this, you know, it's just so overwhelming to have this enormously long history. It's very complicated technically, or at least it seems very complicated technically initially, with all these abstruse terms and various thinkers you've, you know, probably not even heard of, or I hadn't heard of, that are not part of the, you know, standard canon of the history of political thought. And it's very overwhelming. And so to have a grid where you can kind of neatly kind of slot figures into different categories is an enormous relief initially. But then I think, you know, there's also something to be said for going beyond it, of kind of probing the holes and trying to kind of in some way bring it down once it has stopped serving its initial purpose.
Absolutely. And in fact, I was wondering, exactly because you try to find middle ways, I was wondering what you think can be salvaged of them. Why have people hold on to them so much? But I guess you just said probably necessity or...
but this is a deep question. So in some way, at some point, I thought I would be able to write this book without taking a stance along these lines, where I just simply historicize different figures, different positions. And I'm not really invested in locating the true nature of money or the true origin of money. And that's still part of the ambition of the book in some ways, to push back against accounts of money that have, I think, excessively focused on what you could call ontological questions concerning the nature or origin of money. And they become an obsession that is not entirely helpful either. But I think one consequence has also been that the political dimension of many of these debates, it's kind of become invisible, or at least receded to the background. So I was struck again and again by how much leverage one can get out of simply attending to the political dimension of these disagreements, how an ontological agreement could actually lead to political disagreement, how many things that look like fundamental disagreements about the nature of money actually come down to disagreements about the way in which, you know, the purpose of money was understood, and so on and so on.
One way that I found very helpful, in which you put it at a certain point, is that most people focus on what money is rather than what money is for.
Yeah, and I think one difficulty comes from the fact that you can't separate these different things very easily from one another in the case of money, right? So even though I might want to say, okay, let's just for a moment, let's kind of focus on this aspect, which might require us to kind of maybe silence metaphysical questions, silence economic questions just for a moment, those questions don't disappear. and they are still connected, right? And so that's a really tough thing, a tough balance to strike, to be attuned to these questions while nonetheless moving the focus to something else for a moment.
Okay, so let's delve in these different ways of thinking about money. You begin by looking at Aristotle, and that's one of my favorite chapters, probably because it's the furthest away, in a way. You start from describing the Athenian context, and you explain the tetradrachma?
Yeah, so like a 4-drachma piece, yeah.
Had a fiduciary value added to the mere value of the silver of the coin. And that extra value was given to the trust that traders were giving to the stability of the polis. And then you argue that according to Aristotle, the correct use of money results in reciprocal justice, and that it can do so in three different ways: by equalizing citizens, by standing for a measure of political justice, and by cultivating practical wisdom and deliberation. I know it's a lot, but I think it would be so interesting if you could say a little bit about these three ways.
So first of all, when kind of conceptualizing the structure of the book, I thought of this, and I say this also at the beginning, as a kind of excavation through different layers. And there is something natural in some way from actually having, from reading the book from the back in that sense, right? So the excavation starts at the surface, at the layer closest to us. And I was seriously tempted to actually flip the structure around like this. And I, in the end, I decided against it for a number of reasons. One of the reasons was that I actually liked the sense of shock and defamiliarization that comes from starting at the layer that is furthest removed from us. Right? So very quickly, does it become clear that this is not quite the money that we think we know. Something else is going on here. The language used, you know, like reciprocity, justice, and so on. It's a different language. And so, you know, I'm glad the shock is still there, because it was my shock originally. Just to kind of say a few more words before I get to Aristotle. In the background here is a kind of mystery of economic history, which revolves around the monetization of the Greek world, like the way in which coined money spread very quickly from the 7th century BC throughout the Eastern Mediterranean, to the point that 200 years later, several hundreds of Greek polis were all coining their own money, and often very small entities, and each their own. And they often insisted that you could only use their own money to pay for things on their market, right? And so that has long been a puzzle for economic historians, because if you believe the account that this is simply a story of efficiency, something is amiss, right? So if you move from weighing gold and silver towards a stamped gold or silver coin, like, it's all about efficiency. You don't need to weigh it every single time. Instead, you just look at it and it tells you 5 or 4 in this case, right? So that's more efficient. But how do you explain 500-600 different polis all issuing their own money? That's not efficient. That's extreme monetary fragmentation. So something else must be going on here that is not captured by efficiency alone. That's where I follow, you know, an older generation of ancient historians like Moses Finley, for example, who've always, you know, pointed towards a political dimension that was part of this, a symbolic dimension that somehow it mattered that, you know, usually the kind of deity of the city and some, you know, important symbol of the city was on the coins, and that they had a value that was beyond their economic meaning. You know, Walter Benjamin, the German critical theorist, once observed that actually ancient coins, you know, are really one of the very few, maybe the only mass medium that was truly, you know, circulating in these societies, right? Like, what else could be produced at scale and reproduce meaning in this way? Like, everyone would be looking at that symbol. You know, everyone would be looking at the symbol of the polis for every single transaction. And so that's the opening. So and that extends far beyond Aristotle, right? This also happens 200 years before Aristotle. And yet it's still a fairly new institution. It's not quite settled. People don't quite know yet what to do with this. I mean, not least because, for example, in the world of Homer, there is no money, coined money yet in that sense, right? So you can tell that something had happened between the world of Homer, which provided so much of the kind of imagination, and the actual kind of day-to-day transactions in the polis of the 5th or 4th century. And I think I turn to Aristotle here as simply one I think, particularly interesting, but also enormously influential figure who dedicated himself towards understanding the role of this fairly new institution. Now, so that's the, now we had Aristotle. The second thing to say is the shock that we feel when we read about these descriptions of money not mapping onto our account of what money is, I think the same probably would have been true for many ancient citizens, right? So this is not an accurate description of what money was actually doing at the time. You know, there were parts of this, elements of this, but probably most of the time people would have thought of money also as a source of corruption and seduction rather than a tool of reciprocal justice and political justice. So what Aristotle is doing here is looking at an institution, an imperfect institution as it exists, and trying to work out, okay, what role does it actually fulfill? What positive role should it fulfill? You know, what is its relationship idealized in a political association as we would want it to exist? So that's important because in some way, the account that he outlines is already proven wrong or it's already out of tune by the realities of his own day. And yet it's an extremely seductive vision of what money could be that fueled generations and generations of scholars following him. And so it's worth recovering, not because it's correct, not because it accurately described what happened in Athens and we just need to get back to this, but because it's one of these kind of parts of the monetary imagination that once unleashed is out there, you know, and shaped so many thinkers who came afterwards. So when Aristotle thinks about this, now we're actually talking about the three worlds. When Aristotle thinks about this, he fits money essentially into his existing scheme of the way in which political justice and political communities operate. And he's trying to be agnostic about the values that they take. So this is explicitly meant as an account of political justice that is equally applicable to political societies that describe themselves as democratic or aristocratic and so on, or monarchic. There's always a kind of good and bad form of the rule of the one, the rule of the few, and the rule of the many. But essentially, it's meant to be agnostic concerning the applicability. So the scheme of political justice that Aristotle elaborates, in particular in Book 5 of the Nicomachean Ethics, is essentially one of giving each person what they're due according to whatever society the society they're in thinks they're due. Right, so it's a kind of meta theory of what political justice would do. And on that meta level, political justice turns out to revolve around, in some way, finding the right mean between things, avoiding excess and avoiding, in some way, lack or poverty, insufficiency. Now, different societies will have different radically different ideas of what that looks like. If you're in a democratic society, then conceptions of inequality and excess will look very different compared to an aristocratic society. But Aristotle insists that all these societies need tools in order to adjudicate, first of all, see, then adjudicate, and then address what counts as excess and how can it be ameliorated. And he thinks societies do this most often through the use of law and the use of speech. So we debate about what is just and what is unjust, what is an excess, what is an unjust inequality. And then we have laws that punish certain transgressions when people take things that they're not meant to take and so on. Now, what is curious and what has, I think, been relatively neglected in that very, very rich scholarship on Aristotle's conception of political justice and the tools of reciprocity that are necessary to bring citizens into a kind of citizen-like relationship with one another, is that it turns out that Aristotle thought coined money actually had a very important role to play in this idealized vision of what political justice could look like. So just as law and speech can be used to, you know, gain advantage for the already powerful, but they're meant to do the opposite. They're meant to rein in excess and introduce equality or justice or, you know, geometric equality in the Aristotelian sense. So a kind of proportionality. Money does the same, according to Aristotle. Once you have coined money, it's possible to see how much people own, for example. You can actually quantify it. You know, you can actually tax it. You can introduce monetary fines. And these were all things that were happening during this time period. So both rewards were denoted in monetary terms and fines were denoted in the unit of account that these city-states were issuing themselves. So there is a kind of monetization happening of the way in which justice is administered. often in close connection to law and speech, but as an important aspect of the way in which justice worked.
Which I find fascinating. My question here is, one may say that money then is a tool of politics rather than intrinsically political. And in fact, I would say it's law and speech as well are not political themselves, although of course they are necessary to politics or they can be used for political means.
So first of all, Aristotle would entirely agree that their money is ideally meant to be a tool, a means to achieve these ends. And things go wrong precisely when people fail to understand that it is meant to be a tool, when they start using it as an end in itself. That's the Mida story in book one of Aristotle's Politics. You know, so that's exactly the account of misuse. Now, why is that still, why is that enough to describe it as political? I would here insist on the way in which the use of money, in particular, when it's used in this correct way, but also when it's used as an end, unnatural sense from Aristotle's purposes, deeply affects the way in which political justice is administered, right? So a tool, by definition, if you use it correctly and it does what it's meant to do, obviously helps you to achieve your overall goal. But in particular, if it's the opposite, if people actually use it as an end and accumulate for its own sake, you know, the repercussions are enormous. So money isn't political simply because it can be successfully used as a tool, and then it would be political, but because the way in which we use it, whether we decide to use it as an end in itself or as a means for what end, each of these things actually has enormously different repercussions, distributive repercussions, repercussions concerning the identity of the people, the symbolic dimension, right? There isn't a way out of this. Even when you say, I refuse to use money as a tool for political ends, that itself is a political choice, right? So this is the way in which I think a thin conception of politics ties money very closely to, you know, these kind of questions of how to live together. That's a very thin conception of politics, but I think it's a helpful starting point to conceptualize why even its rejection should be understood as a political move.
And I guess that then, if this is the operative conception of politics, also law and speech would count as political, exactly because however you use them, they have some repercussions on how we live with one another.
Yeah, in some way, I think the argument is much more intuitively intelligible to us in the case of law, right? So law as a body of rules that decides how we should live, it is obviously political because it quite literally decides how we should live together. Now, a law that is privately issued, if the law, the system of laws would be privatized, that wouldn't make it any less political. It would be a terrible form of politics because one person or one corporation would be able to decide how the rest of society lives. But it would be foolish to say like, oh, in that case, it's no longer political because it's been privatized. Right. So I think actually the argument is much more intuitive for us in that case. And I want to insist on actually drawing a quite strict analogy to the way in which debates about money unfolded. And I should say I entered this not, you know, having this analogy to law and speech on my mind myself, but it struck me again and again. Every single thinker I looked at thinks about money or begins to think about money in drawing analogies to law and speech. That's true for Aristotle, it's true for Locke, it's true for Fichte, it's true for Keynes, it's true for Marx. Now, they all introduce different disanalogies at some point. They want to insist it's similar in this way. They also insist critically that it's an analogy and not identity. Money is not the same as law, but it functions in certain respects, sometimes like the law or like speech. So there's a very productive conversation going on about this thinking in analogy.
The second author you introduce is Locke, and here we take quite a big step forward. We are in the late 1600s, and England is burdened by this long war against France, and the phenomenon of coin clipping is ubiquitous. And actually, I was in Palermo last summer, and in this museum, there was a corner with an exhibition of clipped coins, and just seeing them is quite impressive. Locke insists that this poses a serious threat to the trustworthiness of England, and so starts this massive fight to lead to reconnage. He wins, and all these coins are melted again. It hadn't happened since 1299. You argue that Locke is tying the stability of the coin to the intrinsic value of the metal. You argue that Locke advanced a novel political theory of monetary depoliticization. And I want basically to understand this claim better.
Mm-hmm.
More precisely, I want to understand whether you think Locke himself counts as depoliticizer or whether those after him are those who are depoliticizing money. One tiny more thing I want to say. I'm not totally sold on the idea that just saying that there is an intrinsic value or just tying money to the value of silver is enough to being depoliticizing it.
Mm-hmm.
Because at the end of the day, in my mind, what is political depends on how we use something or the role it plays in society, kind of regardless of whether it's natural or not.
Yeah. Let me first say, so you get a sense now why this book is a ghost story, right? So this is not the claim is not that nothing interesting happened between Aristotle and Locke, but in some way, this is just the second ghost that haunts us. So if Aristotle is this kind of poltergeist that everyone writing about money had to appeal to in one way to another. In fact, you know, we talked about these two camps at the beginning, the kind of orthodox and both claim to be kind of heirs of Aristotle, right? So Aristotle is there because it's really hard to find anyone who's thought about money who hasn't tried to root whatever they're doing in Aristotle. And I think Locke has a different but analogous role in the sense that most of our modern debates about money are, I think, fundamentally shaped by a few moves that are closely tied to Lockeanism and the emergence of a kind of doctrine of sound money that really kind of rises in the 18th and 19th century. And so to return to Locke is once more an attempt to kind of banish the ghost, to kind of actually go to the dead body itself and take a look at what's actually going on there, partially to escape the interpretations, the traditions that emerge from it, and to actually read the text itself and to understand what it's doing. That doesn't mean that the traditions are simply wrong or the interpretations, you know, can be clearly classified as correct or incorrect. And Locke is a good example for that for reasons I'll explain in a moment. But it is, I think, refreshing to kind of just understand, okay, what was Locke's intention in putting this extremely influential argument in the world? You're exactly right about the kind of fine, blurry line between when does a move that is, you know, I think a political move, when does it come to be depoliticizing? You know, what is the point at which we can describe something as depoliticizing? And again, I'm actually on the fence concerning Locke himself. You know, you can look at it in two ways. The traditional reading of these coinage pamphlets has actually been, and like there's a you know, a very, very good 1970s Marxist historian, Joyce Appleby, who wrote most influentially about this. But in this reading, you know, Locke is straightforwardly seen as having naturalized money and thereby entirely removed it from politics, you know, removed it from the political sphere and rooted it in a pre-political sphere of nature. Right? And that's often seen as, you know, in some way aligning the value of silver coins with just the market value of metal. Yeah, so that's one dominant story. And it seemed to me that it captured something, that it captured part of the depoliticizing effect. But if you actually look at Locke himself, it seems like his motivation and his argument doesn't quite fit into this for two reasons, at least. The first is it's overtly politically motivated. So it's clearly an argument that emerges out of worries about societal instability, about kind of post-revolutionary fragility, and the significance of trust in particular, the significance of keeping governments accountable to the promises they make. And so just as coin clipping was seen as a kind of chipping away of societal trust, where people would kind of take a little bit of silver, you know, melt it down and sell it, but try to return the coin now clipped back into circulation at its nominal value. So Locke thought if the government collects all these coins, all these clipped coins in, melts them down and issues them at a kind of, you know, denomination that would actually enlarge the money supply, they would essentially act as public coin clippers. They would contribute to the violation of trust and the breaking of promises. And so this is an extremely political argument about the political significance of trust. There's very little simply about, like, there's very little of an ontological argument of this is simply nature. It's a political argument. Now, it's a political argument that turns out, when successful, unleashes a kind of depoliticization. But that doesn't mean that it's itself a political move, right? And so that's why I use this recurring phrase of the politics of depoliticization. And it depends on you where you place the emphasis. You know, is this the politics of depoliticization, where depoliticization is a kind of magic trick? It's a kind of, you know, a rhetorical move in a political debate, but we all know, wink, wink, what's actually going on? Or do you place the emphasis on depoliticization, the way in which something is truly removed from public debate and cannot be even seen anymore? I think here you see a sliding scale where, you know, as the argument gains force and wins out, the emphasis on nature becomes so strong that it isn't just simply something that nature gives us and we can decide politically how to do it. But by the late 18th century, there really is the sense of this is something that we don't even have to debate. This is something not to be tampered with. This is something given by nature outside of the realm of what we can debate about, right? And so at that point, you're firmly on the depoliticizing side. Right, so that's the one part in which Locke's actual argument doesn't fit the pure naturalization story. The second is that Locke doesn't actually insist on tying it to the kind of world market price of silver, which is in some way what the kind of, you know, straightforward naturalization, privatization, marketization argument in its kind of Karl Polanyi vein would suggest. Instead, he wants to restore a previous sovereign fiat. Right, so this is not about looking at, okay, what is the price of silver in Amsterdam right now? And this is what the value of the coin should be. Instead, it's about recoining at the old Elizabethan rate, restoring the promise that was once made. Now, that means that the silver content and the nominal content won't map onto what world prices dictate. So again, it's not about naturalization. It's about restoring trust in this original political promise. So for Locke's case himself, it seems to me much more like a political argument, like has based on a political understanding, quite close actually in its premises to Aristotle's argument. It insists that money is conventional, that it's a kind of creation of our imagination, but, and here it differs from kind of dominant Aristotelian interpretations at the time, it thinks that money is too important politically to be left to nominalist political discretion, to political voluntarism. And as a result, previous political promises need to be somehow almost constitutionally enshrined. These are things that we've committed to, and once committed to, they cannot be changed. And that's the very, very weird way in which Locke uses intrinsic. Not intrinsic in the intuitive sense of actually describing what, you know, a gram of silver might be worth on the European market, but instead intrinsic value as aligning it with that old political promise again. There's another dimension to this, which, you know, plays into this, and it kind of troubles Locke's argument, which is the increasingly global dimension of silver at this moment, right? So silver in the late 17th century is increasingly a global commodity, heavily imported to China and a driver of world trade, if you so want. So there's a colonial dimension as well, which, you know, you might initially think ties more closely into the naturalizing argument. But you have to remember that Locke thinks about this from the perspective of the kind of English colonial state. How does the English colonial state administer this? And once more, rooting this promise to the old Elizabethan standard of value is actually a very effective tool of colonial governance from that perspective.
This is all great. And I think shows once more the limits of the nominalist versus naturalist debate. I'm very glad you brought up the importance of trustworthiness and the moral argument that underlies Locke's choice, because exactly what I was thinking was, how can it count as the politicization if the motives are so political? So yeah, I guess we need to live with this ambiguity
That's exactly right. There's a deep ambiguity in this politics of depoliticization, where people actually see completely different things when they look at it. I think actually, I mean, I'm using the language of magic a little bit in the book to describe this, because I think that gets closest to the kind of optical illusions that attend this. You know, like it's not quite in one place. Depending on how you look at it, you see slightly different things. And that's part of what it's meant to perform. In some way, tell some people that this is something that is deeply political, and yet make it seem to other people that this is something beyond politics. And it has to do both of these two things at the same time.
You make me want go and read Locke. I really want.
Which is quite a feat. I'm usually not the biggest connoisseur of Locke. And actually, I didn't set out writing a chapter about Locke.
I'm glad you did. Just one final brief question on Locke. You highlight how his own involvement in foreign trade may have affected his theory of money, which I thought was very interesting, because we are not used to think of theories as being motivated by personal drives. Does this tell us that any economic theorization is inevitably bound to the personal experiences and idiosyncrasies of the theorist? You set up the context of each author before delving into their theories, and you really bring to the surface how important it is to understand their theory as a reaction to the current crisis they are living. What do we make of that thought? Like, do we just accept that each theory is historically motivated and rooted? Or should we just, once we acknowledge it, try to take a bird's eye view and think, I know that I am situated, it's 2023, this is the crisis I'm living in, but I should try to abstract from that and summarize whatever I've learned from previous crises as well.
Yeah, well, that's a deep question. So let me start with the kind of more pedestrian aspect about the personal circumstances and the crises. I mean, I am quite committed to this kind of contextualization, both of the political history, the economic history, but also the sense of crises that engulf these different thinkers as one important key to make sense of what they were writing and thinking. And that means most obviously that their own diagnosis of the crisis obviously affects the problem that they're trying to solve. Depending on how they frame the problem, their solution will differ. And so there's a way in which we're kind of entrapped almost in other people's previous framings of crises, right? Like, irrespectively of whether Locke's diagnosis of the problem of trust was correct, the solution that he invented is now, you know, with us still. Right, so it's, at that point, it's no longer relevant whether his diagnosis was correct because of the influence of his account. I don't want to say that I'm able to kind of give this objective historical account of this is the crises, this is what. Instead, it's neither that nor is it simply personal idiosyncrasy, nor is it simply a kind of psychohistory, you know, like we need to know, understand everything about the personal lives of these people to understand what they write about these very abstract questions. But it's something in between. In particular for money, it does matter, you know, what the crisis is that you think you find yourself in. And that is defined not just by the kind of obvious economic and political conditions, you know, in Locke's case, you know, the importance of the Glorious Revolution and the political instability that preceded and followed it. Not just the kind of fact of colonial expansion and the way in which Locke was intimately involved in that and had knowledge of it, but also the kind of like fears and anxieties that would be fueled by these things. Right? And that's where I guess where it gets a little bit more personal. The ambitions, the visions that empire would conjure up, the fears that societal collapse could produce in the late 17th century in the wake of this bloody, you know, bloody century. And so these, I think, are important to understand why certain authors hang on to particular framings of crises, why they elevate certain problems to the level of crisis and other things just disappear. Locke's example is a great one, I think, because the recoinage that occurs produces fewer coins than beforehand. So you have a monetary contraction, which has enormously devastating consequences for most people living at the time. Now, Locke is kind of aware of this, but he seems entirely oblivious to this, right? So it's really interesting, like what is declared a crisis and what isn't? And in this case, the crisis is trust that needs to be fixed. And a shortage of money, people actually, I mean, there are accounts, horrifying accounts of suicide rates shooting up in the wake of the recoinage because of just the kind of poverty and shortage of money. It just simply doesn't register. Or similarly, whether your sympathies align with those of creditors or debtors. right? So the creditors obviously would be most in favor of Locke's suggestions, whereas the debtors had most to lose out. And guess how that played out, right? And so there's something really interesting about the kind of partial blindness that leads thinkers to focus on one thing and just be entirely kind of oblivious to something else. Now, how does that affect us? And are we able to step out of this? I think we can try, but I think our language, and it inevitably will be language that we use in order to make sense of these questions, like the abstraction will have to proceed by way of language. The language is itself so steeped in these different historical layers that I think we can't escape it. So, you know, we should try to abstract, we should try to adapt things to our own circumstances, or at least try to gain some distance to previous periods. But I don't think that will be possible in a way that is ever safe. And if that's the case, I think it's better to be aware of that history and be aware of the ghosts, as I mentioned earlier, rather than giving yourself into the idea that you can engage in abstraction in a way that is entirely and safely cut off from history. Because I think if you do that, you're actually more likely than not to reproduce certain ideas from the past than to really liberate yourself from them. So I share the overall ambition, but paradoxically, I think in order for us to think for ourselves, we actually need to do more historical work. Now, that's a cliche that has long been associated with historical contextualism. In fact, it's not too far removed from a kind of turn of phrase that Quentin Skinner once used in a very influential essay, you know, that the point of contextualization is to allow us to think for ourselves. Now, that's, I think, cutting it a little too simplistically, but there is some truth to the idea that you need to have an awareness of the historical layers in order to at least be able to try to step away from them a little bit.
The next ghost you talk about is Fichte, though I would say that you don't treat him as a ghost as much as Aristotle and Locke, because his fortune was probably less deep than theirs. I had the impression that you present him as someone who's been more unduly forgotten or not really taken seriously, rather than as a ghost that we have to grapple with. And in your book, I think he counts as someone quite far away from Locke. Again, correct me if I'm misunderstood. And as someone who's very experimentalist and as someone who's living at a time where, again, because of a war with France, the convertibility of paper money into gold has been stopped. And he just embraces that. And he goes like, okay, great. So it's not convertible. It's our choice. Great. How do we think of it now? This lasts for a couple of decades, all goes well, and yet then the world decides to go back to the gold standard. So already in my mind, there's this mythical now figure of Fichte as this revolutionary trailblazer. I wanted to ask you something about his understanding of money as having artificial value. According to Fichte, a fiat currency is more rational because it's allowed and enabled by this rational and intentional and self-conscious ability of deciding on the value of money versus what he sees as these fluctuating gold standards that just oscillates without being actually driven in a self-conscious way. But one may also say, well, both are quite conventional. Both are quite arbitrary. So how are we to understand that difference, really?
Yeah. First of all, I like this idea of Fichte being a very peculiar ghost that kind of never bothers us, you know? And there is something to it. It's much more, repeatedly recurring zombie is the right image, or just a ghost that lives far, far off. But there is a way in which obviously the reception of Fichte's argument is not even nearly as pronounced as the influence of the kind of Lockean sound money argument. And yet, you know, Fichte, first of all, has a fairly substantial reception in France, more than in the Anglosphere, more than in Germany. Like the closed commercial state actually gets translated into French quite quickly. And then I think it also maps onto a kind of recurring urge that is not a constant refrain of the history I'm telling, but that comes out repeatedly in moments of crises of we just perfectly align sovereignty and monetary value, right? So in some way that you find an echo of that in MMT over the last 10, 15 years, but you can also find similar ideas in the interwar years and in previous crises. So it does have a certain recurring force, you know, that is repressed and then in moments of crises bursts forth. And I think that's the way in which I kind of, you know, similarly think of him as having that ghost-like quality. And yeah, he's a philosophical radical. He's having fun. The text is a polemic. It's a deeply polemical text. It's a great text to teach, actually, I found, because, you know, it does some really radical stuff within a very short amount of space. So you get an argument for not just complete fiat money, but also the abolition of all international trade and a kind of complete reconceptualization of the conception of property, whereby guaranteeing the right to property, according to Fichte, entails that the state upholds the right of full employment for everyone. Right? So you get all this in a short essay of 100 pages written in 1800. You know, and it was meant to shock, and he knew this would not be realized in any way. But he's having fun, like driving certain arguments and intuitions to their logical conclusions. And one way in which he's having fun is precisely with this inversion of arbitrariness versus nature, right? So the standard trope of the time is, look at this, you know, gold coin. It has its value in nature. Look at this piece of paper money instead. You know, it's a totally arbitrary thing. It says 1,000 on it, but, you know, it's worth nothing. So one thing has natural value. The other one is purely arbitrary. And Fichte flips this around and says, like, wait, hold on. It turns out that actually, you know, this gold coin actually derives its value from the kind of world market price of gold. That's something that's entirely beyond your control. When new gold mines get discovered, suddenly the price collapses. Even without massive new discoveries, they're constant fluctuations. It's not stable at all. And I think for us, the best analogy would be like some kind of Bitcoin or so. You know, like it might be fixed in terms of quantity, like the amount of Bitcoin is limited. You can't mine more than, I think, 21 million. But because of oscillations in demand, the price will fluctuate wildly, entirely arbitrary. And so Fichte thinks of this as like, look, what you describe as nature and this thing that is supposedly safe actually delivers you to the kind of external fate of arbitrary world market prices. How do you know they're going to move in your direction, or how you know they're going to be stable? You have no guarantee. Compared to a fiat currency along the lines that he proposes, which would essentially entail a kind of rational state, like the Vernunftstaat, so a state actually actively dedicated towards the public interests of its citizens, dedicating itself to the task of maintaining a stable value. Not too different from what central banks are kind of mandated to do for us today. It's like obviously it would be much less arbitrary and more rational to have a system in which there is an entity entirely dedicated towards guaranteeing its stability, rather than tying itself to a market. And he even turns this around and says, like, if history had been a little bit different, he says, like, it would be perfectly imaginable that, you know, people had used paper money for a long time, and then someone came along with a gold coin, and people would like laugh at them. It's like, why would I give up my good piece of paper for your silly piece of gold? You know, like I'm not so foolish to fall for that trick. And so, he's having fun, but he's making a profound point, I think, here about the arbitrariness of the laws of political economy. You know, that might be rooted in quote unquote nature, but that essentially tie all your decisions to market forces that you cannot control, that are fundamentally capricious. And there is an 18th century tradition, like a post-Kantian tradition, that opposes to this a rational state of actually saying, like, we can do better than that. We can actually use the law in order to abolish arbitrariness and come up with rules that actually allow us to live together in a way that is more predictable and more rational, more aligned with justice.
Hearing you explaining Fichte gives me the impression that I understand better his relationship to Marx. Fichte is having a similar kind of intuition to Marx.
With the difference that Marx has an account of capital and capitalism, right? So Marx would say that all these attempts to found the Vernunftstaat under capitalism are foolish, right? You know, there is no possibility for that. So only once you kind of actually leave capitalism behind can you reach that level of emancipation, if you so want, that level of actually self-government. Whereas for Fichte, he thinks in some way, once you cut yourself off from world trade, you know, and it's dedicated to the Prussian finance minister, you know, so you're kind of backward, small, landlocked country, like a small, like, you know, a provincial part outside of what is already a kind of capitalist core. This is not England, without any, you know, foreign possessions, without any international trade and sufficient things. Yeah, in that case, you might be able to kind of cut yourself off and realize some level of control. But obviously, you know, that underestimates the way in which the entire world kind of goes down a capitalist path of development. You know, I think that's also what contributes to the lack of reception of the piece. And, like, you know, people reading it 10, 20 years later already would have lived in a radically different world.
Yeah, absolutely. Then Victor had a much more optimism reaction, but both saw how crucial market relationships were for the value of money.
Yeah.
But maybe, yeah, let's get to Marx. Maybe the toughest chapter. Very rich, very dense.
Took me the longest to write, I think, it's fair to say.
The big takeaway, I think, is salvaging Marx from the accusation that he just skipped the question of money. Mm-hmm. And I think you make a great case to say the question around money was his question. And he spent decades on that question. It's just he got to an answer, which is it's not there we need to look, because we need a deeper solution. And no monetary legislation could ever affect the status quo unless we also change what's underneath, which are deeper social relationships.
That's a great summary.
You say, because of this, he's not interested in money and value as much as in the value form. I wanted to understand better this notion of the value form and also how he detaches himself from both naturalizing theories of money and nominalist theories of money.
Yeah, you're right. There's a very dominant trope out there about the way in which Marx essentially just kind of adopted the kind of gold standard beliefs of his time and didn't have either much to say about money. I mean, on some accounts, even quite charitable accounts otherwise, that try to reintroduce Marx into the conversation, there's sometimes a sense in which, you know, Marx just wrote before the age of financialized capitalism. So he has something to tell us about labor and industrial capitalism and factories, but he just can't tell us much about the way in which hedge funds operate and the way in which kind of contemporary capitalism uses money as this kind of very liquid form of capital. And one motivation of the chapter was to just show that fundamentally underestimates how deep Marx's engagement with all these questions were of credit, of hedge funds, of, you know, financialized capitalism, as we would call it, for 20 years or more, running up to volume one of Capital. So whatever he ended up doing in volume one of Capital, and the mystery is that money and the history of money and the politics of money is almost completely excised from the main body of the text. That was the starting point for me, the gap between the main body of the text and the kind of remnants of that history in the footnotes. So that's still there. So how do we account for that absence in the main body of the text, the decision to elevate this formal concept of value to the center of the book, with the fact that he was actually deeply steeped in all these, you know, debates about the history of money, about contemporary monetary reform, and so on and so on? That means liberating him once more from these two camps, that he's not just simply a kind of, you know, unthinking adherent of the gold standard who just never thought about this, or someone whose account of the money form straightforwardly aligns him with other, you know, naturalists or so on. Instead, what you encounter is, first of all, a rejection of the entire discourse around monetary reform. And I think that's quite important. That is actually a uniting thread between both his critique of many branches of French socialism. Right. So at that point, it becomes really important to understand that most of Marx's texts, in particular Capital, are kind of anti-socialist, you know, texts. They are trying to articulate his vision of communism, and they're directed against the dominant forms of, in particular, French, but also kind of Owenite socialism, which in many ways incorporated strong elements of monetary reform. And similarly, his critique is aligned here with the rejection of, you know, more liberal and conservative attempts at, you know, we would call it better financial regulation, which is similarly happening during this time. You know, if only we could regulate banks better, if only we could have a better, like a more rational way of administering the gold standard, then monetary crises would disappear. And Marx's starting point is, having studied both of these two bodies of thought extensively, to reject essentially both for the same reason, saying that both of them fail to understand the peculiarity of the value form under capitalism. And so that's the starting point. And that, I think, partially explains why he's so meticulously excised debates about money and monetary reform from the main body of the text of Volume 1 of Capital. And instead, we get these opening chapters, which are some of the most, you know, difficult chapters to read because they're so formal. But the argument, as I read it, that emerges from this is not one that aligns him with either of the existing camps, but instead kind of establishes him as offering yet another kind of hybrid way of thinking about this. So it's obviously not the kind of nominalist Fichtean account, at least not under capitalism. Right? Under capitalism, you can't just make money do what you want to do, because it's a form of capital and, you know, it has its own, in some way, agency from that perspective. On the other hand, nor is it an account that wants to reduce money to commodities, but instead almost the opposite. It wants to reduce commodities to money. That flips things completely around and means that he is a critic of the Lockean position. He's a critic of the sound money position and at the same time, a critic of the Fichtean position. Right. So, and you get a kind of very complicated account of the constraints that the value form imposes under capitalism, the way in which any attempt at monetary reform that fails to change the underlying structures of production will not be able to overcome either exploitation or the kind of instability of the financial system. The problem here is, I think this goes a little bit beyond the chapter, but your question touched on it. It's not at all clear what this tells us beyond capitalism. Like so much with Marx, we know a lot more about his thoughts on capitalism than about post-capitalism, right? The Volume 1 of Capital is about capitalism, and it gives us an account of how attempts at monetary reform, attempts at monetary policy will be constrained by considerations of value in his sense. It doesn't tell us what will happen if that conception of value doesn't exist anymore. You know, will that look more like a kind of Fichtean account? Will it look more like a kind of abolition of money vision, where money just simply disappears? We actually don't know a whole lot about this, and we can speculate a bit. But what I was more interested in is trying to understand his critique, double multi-layered critique of various available options under capitalism. Maybe if I can add one more thing to this, that's a little different from the political impact of that assessment. So I think there is a very sound analytical intervention here about the importance of value that I think is very difficult to escape also for us today. I think it's a very good starting point to begin with this appreciation of the constraints. And yet, and this is a similar story about Marx versus Marxism, it's not entirely clear to me that we need to conclude from that, that there aren't important political struggles to be fought within capitalism around questions of money reform. They won't lead to the abolition of capitalism. They won't fulfill either the promises of the Proudhon socialists nor of the kind of liberal legislators who hope to abolish monetary crises. But they will nonetheless be crucial forms of organizing, crucial forms of distributive and political struggles. Now, Marx, and in particular Marxists after him, thought that this was just a hopeless area of political struggle. You know, much better to kind of organize labor on the factory floor than to engage in that world of credit, which I think was a very sound political strategic assessment in the 1860s and 70s, in a world in which central banks were still private institutions, after all. It seems to me that one can hold on to the analytical core of his critique and nonetheless question the political strategic conclusion that this is simply something that we don't need to worry about or talk about or invest our political resources in. Instead, I think, and this is where the kind of book all ends, that there is a way in which one can actually establish a more effective political strategy of mobilization and intervention by being aware of the constraints, by being aware of the fact that this won't abolish financial crises, this won't abolish capitalism. And yet these are struggles worth fighting because they make an enormous difference to people on the ground. Just as Marx thought it made an enormous difference whether the working day was 8 hours or 14 hours. You know, that's still an important struggle.
One more thing I wanted to ask you about Marx is maybe more positively, exactly because he rejects both pure nominalist and pure naturalist positions. He understands the value of money as deriving from the process of evaluation. it is in the exchange that the value of money lies. And I guess this is what you meant before when you said that he tries to make a commodity's money rather than money a commodity.
Mm-hmm.
Is this how we should understand his claim that money is a social relation? And at what level should we read that? Because at the beginning, my imagination just goes with barter more easily than with the globalized world. I was like, oh yeah, of course, I want to buy something, you want to sell something. This is the individual level, the evaluation that matters. But then you talk about the public's and industry demands for money. So I was like, oh, wait, maybe we're talking more at a global level. And also, whilst you were talking now, I had the impression that what you were saying would make sense at every level, whether we're talking about the factory, the world, the individual level. So how should we understand that money is not a thing, but a social relation?
So first of all, I think that is part of the problem brought about by this extremely formal method in the book. So much of the discussion is actually about highly stylized examples, often, you know, two persons exchanging something, right? That's the, for example, the context of Marx's discussion of Aristotle in Volume 1 of Capital. So on that level, it does seem to suggest like something quite personal, and the social relation quality comes from that. But then at other points, it surely has to scale up, and it's something that holds on a higher level as well. So I would think actually it tracks across. I don't think it's something that purely happens in these kind of individualized circumstances. Maybe the way to answer it, though, is to insist that like what happens to the social relation under capitalism? For Marx, it's still a social relation, but it has become commodified. And so that might be one way to understand the way it would be applicable even between entities that are entirely removed from individuals, you know, that have a legal personhood of some kind, where there is still this trace of a social relation there, but it's a social relation that's deeply embedded in capitalist, you know, structures of production on a very high level. So that might actually be one way in which we can account or we can describe and capture the way in which under capitalism, this kind of money social relation has become commodified. So there might not be a tension between the two, but this might be the very purpose of what he's trying to get at.
The last author you analyze and dialogue with is Keynes. Probably in my mind now, as much of a trailblazer as Fichte, probably more. He tries to learn his lesson from all the authors we've been discussing. We should strive towards an account of money that both ensures domestic stability and international cooperation and peace. He puts forth this utopia. I had the sense that you are sympathetic, not just with Keynes' proposal, but also with his spirit, most of all, with the daring spirit of we should aim high. So how would his utopia work? And, you know, a common objection to Marx is always it's too utopistic. So how does Keynes' vision embed Marx whilst differentiating it from him and from you? Like how does your overall vision differ from theirs?
So first of all, it's a lot of fun reading Keynes, and I'm doing more work on Keynes now. And part of it is just the kind of eloquence and brilliance, but part of it is also the kind of boldness. Like once he doesn't hesitate just, you know, sketching these extremely ambitious things on the back of a proverbial napkin or so. You just like find these extraordinary sketches and visions again and again, often in his letters and private correspondence. And I think there is something to be said for that ambition. But you're right to observe that like Keynes seems to have a slightly different voice in the book. There's a line in the book that says this is not a story of heroes and villains. And like I've gotten periodic pushback against that by people who claim that actually Keynes seems to look an awful lot like a hero in the book. And I can understand why. Part of it has to do with the fact that he's not just simply another ghost. He's not just simply another. He's also that, but not just simply one. But he's also one that explicitly draws onto these other thinkers and tries to in some way combine them in a weird way. Again, refusing to pit them against one another, but insisting on ways in which you can, you know, hold on to Locke and Fichte simultaneously, or to Fichte and Marx simultaneously. And that makes it very interesting, I think, because it's not just simply another dot on the map, another location, but instead you see him grappling with the characters that I've so far dealt with in the book. And yet I thought of him not as a hero, but as a guide. and throughout the book, right? And so that meant for me that I benefited enormously from thinking with him through these questions. But I also was okay disagreeing with him, you know, after having listened to his counsel, taken his advice to place my priorities elsewhere. And there's no shortage of ways in which, you know, he was embedded in his own problems and his own diagnoses of crises, which are not my own, right? And so I think there is actually a task and a possibility for running with Keynes and then diverging from him and translating this. Most obviously, in the case of like my plea in the kind of closing epilogue of the book, that we actually need to think much harder about democratizing the institutions that govern monetary policy. You know, Keynes would not have been in favor of that. You know, he had bold visions about monetary reform and bold ideas for how that would work, but he was a fairly consistent critic of attempts to kind of internally democratize, let's say, central banks. So that's one example where it would do as well to insist on a much more egalitarian conception of democracy, both domestically and internationally, than fit it into his conception. Now, that at the same time means that in some way we are open to the charge of being even more utopian again, you know, where like the bar gets higher and higher. So it's not enough to have monetary reform to make things like a little less silly, a little less irrational. But I would like to see it also democratized, you know, with all the kind of potential tensions that introduces between, you know, having a good democratic process and getting to the things that we also want, which might conflict with one another. Keynes, I think, had a commitment, which, you know, might be a healthy intuition again to start with, of a kind of deep conception of almost Burkean expediency. So he was deeply committed to just analyzing the kind of crises that he found himself in, the power constellations in it, and detecting what room of maneuver is there. And he was extremely good at this very quickly to kind of just see what are the futile battles and what are the things that one could really kind of focus on. At the same time, he was able to do this without giving up on an extreme idealism at the same time. He's a really extraordinary sense of being both committed to kind of, you know, Burkean pragmatism and an almost Platonic idealism, where he has certain values that he just thinks are kind of timelessly true. And then the problem of politics is obviously a problem of time in some way. Like, how do you reconcile these problems of expedience in the present with these timeless values? But that's what he's doing again and again, and insisting that his solutions are not utopias, not non-places, but that they are real existing places, e-utopias, he calls them. So when he's sketching an international system for monetary reform, the kind of international clearing union during World War II, it's kind of hard to say whether it's excessively ambitious or excessively lacking in ambition. You know, so on the one hand, it's further removed for us than ever before. Like, we have like no hope, I think, of getting to this. And at the same time, he accommodated, for example, great power status of the world in which he lived. Like, it's not an egalitarian system that he envisaged, but one in which some powers would have vastly more influence than others. And he thought that it was necessary to make sure it's not a utopia, but an e-utopia. It's something that could actually happen. Imperfect as it might be, it can actually happen. That's something to take inspiration from, even when we disagree with it, even when we place our values differently, even when we have a different conception of the pragmatism of the initial situation, of the crisis that we find ourselves in, of the values that guide us. I think in his case, it was much more justice and like an abstract Platonic sense than democracy or equality. So we might want to kind of substitute our values for this, but the overall framing of holding on both to pragmatic analyses of a crisis that we find ourselves in and very high-minded ideals simultaneously, and finding institutional solutions of not entirely aligning them, but at least connecting them in some way, that seems to me the right kind of ambition.
If I can press you a bit more on this, I think in Keynes, there's the idea, for example, of a global bank that manages the international trade is kind of ambitious, but also I can imagine that, you know, like I can imagine a world like that. And where he compromises is exactly the democratization instead. So he's happy to dream in that direction, but then he says, yeah, money should be a matter for public debate, but at the end of the day, there should be this group of experts, a technical bunch who deals with the technical aspects. And you do very well in bringing out this tension again between these regulative ideals of his and the reality of facts.
Yeah.
What then I found surprising is that your intuitions, like your gut feeling, seems to be reversed. I had the impression that instead you were like a central bank that goes above everyone is completely out of reach, whereas democratization is doable. Democratization of money in the public debate. Am I right in thinking that this is your own view?
I think that's a great diagnosis. I think my readjustment of this, which you captured perfectly, comes from both sides. So there's an assessment about that's the pragmatism side, you know, like what is actually possible. And it seems to me very, very far removed to imagine something like a Bretton Woods tool right now in this moment, as much as we would need it. It seems easier to begin a debate about democratizing certain ways in which we govern money within our existing democratic systems. In fact, I think to some extent, the social movements already exist that call for that, right? It's not that I kind of want to conjure that up into the world, but there are forces out there that push for it against opposition, but I'm aligning myself with those forces. But in some way, there's already a kind of, there are already calls for this. There are already political struggles over this within certain democracies, you know? So that's the pragmatism side. But then there's also the ideal side, where I also think we have a lot more to lose by not trying the democratization. So at that point, it's less about my confidence that we can actually do this, as much more my fear of the costs of not trying it. So, and that comes in two different shapes. The first one is that I'm increasingly convinced that by carving out such a significant area of public policymaking that affects all our lives in so many different ways, two entities that are just attached to a mandate that actually very poorly captures what they do day to day. You know, like most of the stuff that happens in contemporary central banks has to do with the way in which they intervene in the credit system, not simply price stability. The legal system under which there's democratic kind of mandate-based authorization doesn't quite capture the power that central banks really have. And by removing such an enormously powerful and influential area of policymaking from direct democratic accountability, like being able to get rid of someone or being able to actually hold them accountable, I think risks not just producing monetary policy that is unjust, but it also risks undermining our entire democratic ethos that we are actually engaged in a project of collective self-governance. Because if we don't trust ourselves to govern this, like what's the point of this? No, like we've kind of given away the tools that would actually be able to change our lives. Instead, we have a kind of like democratic debates within constraints that allow us to, you know, decide of whether we could close the public library or the public swimming pool. You know, that's the level on which public democratic debate takes place. And I don't think that's sustainable for democracies. I think that actually ends up undermining the entire principle of the project we're engaged in. At that point, I don't know whether it's possible to democratize money. I actually don't know. There are lots of good reasons why it's going to be extremely difficult. And yet, it seems like not trying to at least democratize it, like in the gerund way, of at least like trying to extend a little bit more democratic accountability, having a sense of this is something that we at least aspire to collectively govern ourselves through, actually risks causing much, much greater damage about democracy overall.
I think this is a great note on which to stop and a very important reminder. I find myself to be so boringly pessimistic, so it's really refreshing to hear these things. And yeah, our traditional way of concluding the episodes is to ask, what are you working on now?
Actually, more canes. Lot more canes.
I look forward to are you working on a new book on canes?
Yeah, I'm working on a new book, but I'm also trying to use canes to think about questions of climate finance and, you know, more kind of contemporary credit reform issues that I think occur when you push these questions actually into institutional territory.
Then I look forward for it to be published, and I hope to have you again on board. This was fantastic. Thank you so, so much for your time and passion.
Thank you so much, Julia. It was really great to be here.
And have a lovely day.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Okay, so welcome back. I have the great pleasure of introducing Achilles myself now. We ended up chatting for quite a long time with Stefan. I think several interesting points emerged. I hope that everything was sufficiently clear because the book is so rich and dense that I was afraid that we would have jumped immediately into the critical part without spending too much time on the explanatory part, especially when it comes to talking about each individual author's proposals.
So first of all, I think it was a great interview. I thought Stefan was very generous with his answers. You asked the right questions, I think, to move the conversation in the way that it moved. In that sense, it was all very clear and very easy to follow, despite it being an uncommon subject and in many respects, a subject that we don't think about in those terms. The book itself must be fascinating. Is there something you want to start off with?
I covered pretty much all of the main points. I'm very, very happy that we managed to talk about different kinds of utopias or eutopias, as Keynes was talking about his own proposal. Something that doesn't, I think, come as clearly in the book is how different Stefan's and Keynes and Marx's versions are. So yeah, he was very generous in sharing.
So I had a question on that actually as well. So maybe we can begin from there and then we can work our way back to Aristotle, about whom I had some questions. That was really cool. So when you and Stefan were talking about the distinction between Stefan and Keynes, the key distinction was, as far as I understood, that Keynes was in favor of an expert-driven council of people that worry about money in society, and Stefan wanted a more democratically driven council is the wrong word, but yeah, something like that. The people that are involved in making decisions about money in society are sort of democratically chosen rather than elected because they're experts or chosen because they're experts. From what I gathered from Stefan, the reason why he wants to take that position is because, so one, we're a democratic society, so clearly democratically electing people is an important aspect of how our states function. And the role of money in society is a really important thing, and it plays a huge role in our lives. And the authority and power held in decisions about money should also come from a similar democratic principle as the formation of our states. Is that all right?
So, I should disclaimer from now on, I think is my interpretation of what Stefan may say, because I'm not sure. But from what I understood, he wouldn't advocate for a group of people that, rather than being chosen by expertise, are elected democratically. I think he's more radical than that. I think he's thinking of the institution of money being managed more democratically, sidestepping the power is in a few people's hand element. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure I understand exactly how that would work, but he doesn't talk about this explicitly. But I think he is uneasy with private banks and most importantly with how much power they have in relation with how little that power is exposed. They play such an important role to the extent that we hear about banks all the time, but don't really visualize how deeply the choices of the people in charge of banks affect our everyday life. The way I was reading his plea to a larger, deeper democratization was actually, let's democratically manage private banks or dismantle them. And let's decide on this democratically, but also let's manage money democratically. And also, sorry, one last thing. Given his emphasis on how we should move from nature to purpose, I think similarly, he would say also the aim of banks as an institution should be much more people, the good of everyone rather than of banks themselves or of the market or something like that. So this is how I understood his positive proposal.
Right. So just to understand, the thing you said, just as the distinction between the movement from nature to purpose, that maps onto what you said about banks, because if you're thinking about banks in terms, money and banks in terms of nature, you're thinking that they're just moments of the market and they're just sort of expressions of the movement of money.
What I wanted to say is that he cares about purpose. Be it when it comes to understanding what are the most important questions to ask about money, or when it comes to understanding how we should think of democratization. So if you ask me, what does he mean by that? I think you would never say, let's think about the nature of democracy, but let's try to focus on what democracy is for.
Okay, so the democratic aspect of money then doesn't have to do with elections, but it's got to do with it being sort of state managed, maybe. It's like a part of the state's oversight, perhaps.
Exactly. I had the impression he didn't want to be too committal on how exactly that would look like. Definitely there was the element of it's absurd that private banks can affect the lives of everyone so much.
Right. Whereas Keynes...
Whereas I think Keynes was either... I mean, again, I'm not sure and I look forward to reading his next book. But from what I understood, he's either pessimistic about human nature, which I myself may like aligned to, or he is just very practically oriented. And he thinks that money and the market, at the end of the day, is such a technical realm of existence that we do need experts to understand how exactly. Because Keynes has this idea of let's monitor and manage the market through overt deliberation. But not everyone has the capacities, simply, to carry that out. So I think he just thinks that experts are needed. I mean, we can all agree on, I don't know, everyone would be better off now versus in 5 years' time if inflation went up or down by this percent or whatever. But how exactly to make that happen is something that only people with a certain specific kind of expertise.
Yeah.
And actually, this would have been a good question to ask him, because maybe then the two proposals are not that incompatible after all.
Does Keynes say anything about private banks?
I'm sure he does.
Is it in Stefan's book?
Perhaps. Because no, I don't want to say no. Maybe I would have to read it another time.
Okay. Well, that sounds really interesting. And I mean, something that I thought about as I was listening to this to your interview was that there's something odd about the objective of this book. Because on the one hand, we talk a lot about money. Money is constantly in our political and social conversations. Last year, we were talking about the British Prime Minister's income and his wife's income. And there was a sense of injustice that they didn't pay tax because of certain tax loopholes. So money is obviously something that we think about a lot. We care about it a lot. It matters to us. Whether certain people make certain amounts of money and other people make other amounts of money is the things that form part of our value judgments, right? About whether someone can do a good job or whether someone deserves what they're doing. But I guess this is the subtlety of Stefan's point, right? It's we're not talking about it or handling it in the way that he would like us, in the way that would make anything meaningfully change or improve our relationship to money as a society or as a political whole?
Yeah, like the first thing I would say is he pushed back when I said at the very beginning, your aim is to bring money to the forefront. So he would take what you just said as an example of his point that we are talking about money now much more and that it's impossible to avoid doing it. However, I also think that you're right in saying that maybe what you just said is not how he thinks of treating money as political. Like, yes, we talk about money as part of what matters, for better or worse. Yet when we ask how much money someone makes, or when we talk about, I don't know, now we hit 30s, so talking about mortgages is very common, and interest rates and all these things. It's as if we talk of money as something that is out there. We need it to do stuff, but we forget that it carries power, that it stems from power, that its lack or abundance affects society in a power dynamic. It's as if we forget a whole dimension. Something that I kept thinking about throughout is the body. I remember that throughout my coming of age, basically, I was witnessing and part of a discourse, which is still very much ongoing, on how the body has a social role. Which, again, if you ask me, what does that mean? It's difficult to pin it down exactly, but I think it's similar. There's one way of thinking about the body as a thing. You are born with it, and that's it. And you can think of yourself as just being your soul. And then there's this heavy thing that you carry with you. Or, as more and more people are highlighting recently, it is social. What does that mean? It's a social object. Well, it means that it's a social construct, but it also means it has a certain kind of power in society. It means it carries certain kinds of values that go over and above what it is. So the way I was trying to understand his claim that money is political is similar. Money is not just a thing, but it's a system. It evokes a whole world. And on it, certain properties emerge, which belong to a world that we usually conceive of as being political rather than just economical. Would you agree?
I'm really not sure. I think it's a very difficult point to put your finger on. We are aware of the power of money. I mean, just some examples that just come to my mind immediately. We are aware of the role of money in elections, let's say, in politics. We are aware of the role of money when a company like Google, for example, has the equivalent, has the ability to exert economic force as if it were a nation state. We are aware of money when we're told that Jeff Bezos is the richest man in the world and, you know, has like the equivalent amount of wealth as the 1 billion people below him.
Yeah, and this is very interesting. I think it also makes me think, well, maybe it also comes down to individual and personal sensitivities. Like maybe in the past 10 years, you've kept yourself more aware than I have.
But this is something that states, governments are grappling with, how to deal with these kinds of companies, for example, that can exert great economic pressure. But this is also why I said, I don't think this is exactly Stefan's point. I really do wonder whether his point is this whole democratically led thing.
Exactly, because I think for me, very illuminating, and sorry for repeating myself, but it's really his claim that the question is not whether money is political, but what politics we want it to be associated with.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's as if now as a society in 2023, in this time and age, after COVID, after the crisis, we are more aware that money is indeed political, but we still need a bit of a push from that awareness to asking ourselves, okay, so what? You know, it's as if even when we talk about how it's political, then we take again a step back, we fall back into this passive state. So we need the law to regulate these rich people. And I think maybe this is the difference. Maybe he wants to say we don't need the law as an external institution to regulate this politically neutral thing that money is, this thing that is created and then changes value and blah, blah, blah. Rather, we need to think from within monetary theory about how things can be different. What is credit? What is interest? Are we sure that this trust system is the only viable one? Are we sure that banks should have this kind of power? Do we want an international currency? Do we want an international central bank? What is the relationship between national banks and private banks and the state?
Yeah, now I'm getting the idea that the kind of politics he's talking about is money being brought within the sphere of the state, but on its own terms, as you said, not just as something that is dealt with by something that is not money.
I would think so. And I also think, to be fair, that his reluctance disclosing super clearly his positive proposal is not to be read as a lack of courage, for example, but really as intellectual honesty, because his message may have been hijacked then. Mm-hmm. Then people would have focused on his positive proposal, whereas the message of the book, as I understand it, it really is, we need to think about this. And yes, of course, I have an idea on how to go on and do this. But what I really need is you all political theorists to pay attention and you all normal citizens to be aware and ask yourself this question.
Okay. I mean, we've kind of touched on what I want to talk about with regard to Aristotle. But something that I was thinking about when you were talking about those three things that Aristotle talks that money should do or can do, the kind of purpose it can serve in society. And I was thinking a lot about money as restorative justice. And I thought that was interesting because, again, I thought that's something that we do a lot, but probably in a different way as well, like speeding fines, right? Or parking fines, or income tax, or inheritance tax, or something else where you've done something wrong, or something wrong in society is identified, and money is used as the medium through which to restore justice. Like higher income tax, let's say, to pay for a welfare state, right? That's kind of like restorative justice in a sense.
Yes. And here again, it's what I asked him as well, which is, does that make money political or is just a tool?
Right.
And I really need some more time to think about this because definitely, but I wonder, when we think about that, do we see money as an institution, money as a system, as a constitutive part of justice, or merely as a tool, which could also be something else? For example, think about the eye for an eye rule and compare and contrast that with the jail system. Are they two different ways of ensuring justice, or is only the latter constitutive of justice? Do you see what I'm getting at? So, for example, if we take money as an institution and we say that it is part of what guarantees distributive justice, would it be the same if we were in a barter society? Yep. Would we then say that barter practices are those that, maybe not, or maybe what he would say is, well, right now you talk as if money is just this piece of metal, whereas money is the system, is the thought, is the social relationship of exchange, be it a piece of paper, a coin, or two chickens. And then I think there are a lot of interesting questions there, like, are the two chickens money? Which is also what we touched upon on the difference between money value and the value form that Marx talks about. And those things, of course, are all the questions that attract me because I think it's one of the most philosophical points of the book. When we talk about money, are we talking about coins, credit, the exchange, the system, the evaluation? He's very explicit in that. And he's like, well, maybe there are different ways of thinking. I mean, there are different ways of thinking about money. And that's what makes things so difficult, because what are we talking about? And it's amazing because the more you think about this book, the more questions you have.
Yeah, I think at this point, I think what would be really helpful for me, for example, would be to have an idea of what it would look like if money was treated politically the way he wants it to. Because I think we're just so used to thinking of money in the ways that we've been thinking about it, that it's difficult for us to imagine it functioning differently. But it's very exciting. What's so cool about it is that you never think of that as money being the thing that requires more state involvement.
But also what you just said is that I would like to see how it works for it to be political. Maybe actually the point is exactly how it works. Like it is political, right? All these things that you've been talking about, they are instances and examples of money being political. What he's saying maybe is simply pay attention. That's political too. So just kill this ambiguity and schizophrenic way that we have of using it as being political, whilst talking about it as being given.
So that's great. I mean, great topic, great interview, Julia. Well done. Fantastic debut.
Thank you. Thank you so much for chatting with me about it. Thank you all for listening to Please Expand, and stay tuned for our next episode.